Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. You want to call in? Join in 1-888-429-5471.
I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
PJ Callahan with us. He's got a BA in English and an MA in journalism. He's worked as a cameraman, but he's always had a love of language and humor, which he brings to his book series, Perino and the World Underneath. Perino and the Gremlin Spies are the first two in a series of six children's books about love, friendship, believing in oneself, and knowing that it's cool to be smart. BJ, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for the gracious invitation. Introduction.
And by the way, I'm very happy you're here tonight, because when you really come down to it, I think that the main theme of the books or the series is that healthy self-esteem, and that's what you say, that's your child's best armor, not only for bullying, but almost every challenge that life can throw at the kids. And I think one of the things that we're running into today, PJ, the kids don't have the self-esteem that's available for them, and I think worse than that, they don't know how to get it.
No, and I think you're exactly right. I think it's a matter of them not embracing their individuality. I think everyone in us has something very special in us, the quality to be great. I think that's easily found when we find something, I guess as Joseph Campbell used to say, follow your bliss.
Yeah.
And whatever makes you happy, and I think if a person finds that, you find happiness, and then you feel very comfortable with yourself. And I think that's essential. I mean, obviously, you love your radio show. That's essential for success in life, not just professional success, but spiritual, just a personal success, a sense of fulfillment.
PJ, somebody said to me years ago, they said, what are you going to do when you retire? And I said, what do you mean retire? I don't work.
Exactly. You hit it right on the head, you know, and these kids, you know, they have, not to be corny, but they have so much love in them, so much curiosity, you know, so they're so inquisitive, they just need to find a place to direct it, and they have to be comfortable with kind of being corny, kind of being geeky, kind of, you know, pursuing their interests. And I think that's not to lash out against reality TV, but I think that's why that genre is thriving so much, because people are living vicariously through that, and they're not developing themselves. You know, they're not being leaders, they're not being individuals, and I think that's just so important, not just professional success, but just a sense of happiness and contentment.
Oh, no question about it. I think when we deal with it, the road of happiness and contentment, the road in and itself leads to one thing. It leads to emotional satisfaction. And the only way that you get that is through being accepted somewhere. And I think that's the major problem with a lot of the kids. They put these masks on and they're frightened to death that they won't be accepted if they think a certain way, because they want to be with the crowd. And the crowd could be a good crowd or a bad crowd. And that's what it is. I think what we have is a generation of kids who wear a lot of masks.
Yeah, and everyone has been susceptible to peer pressure. Everyone has gone through it. Everyone wants to fit in and be liked. But I think what also is a very important feeling is when you do something well, when you've accomplished something. And it's not just for, I guess, professional accolades or social acceptance, but it's like, man, I did a really good job. I did a great job. And see, that's the thing that kids have innately in them, the need and the desire to learn, you know. And I think what I'm trying to stress with my book, because it's basically, it's full of a lot of humor, it's full of a lot of goodness. It's basically if you follow your bliss, if you're true to yourself, you can do great things. And it's cool, like you said in the introduction, it's cool to be smart, but it's cool to be a person, you know, because in the book they're bad characters too, with who are also mischievous and playful. But in the end, you know, good overcomes evil. And I think people have that innate goodness in them. And if they follow their heart, that will lead to greatness.
And by the way, there's got to be a roadmap to get there. And I think that's the one thing that's missing in so many of the kids today. There's nobody to say, put your foot on this path. And if you put your foot on this path, it's going to lead you to a particular end result. You know, there's a beginning, there's a middle, and there is a, I won't say an end, but there is that place of being able to accept yourself. And that in and of itself, when you talk self-esteem, I can say that word, when you talk self-esteem, you also talk about giving yourself permission to be yourself. And I think that in and of itself, PJ, is the biggest problem we have culturally with kids today.
Well, I think you brought up a great point, and the word was permission.
Yeah.
And it's really a sense of freedom. You know, it feels like fear and anxiety, but when you're yourself, when you're in your car, when you're in your room, you're listening to the music you like, you're watching things on TV that you like, you're walking, you're watching squirrels, you're looking at nature. These are things that maybe your so-called friends may think corny, but you really like them. That's essential for happiness. Then when you're true to yourself like that, that just opens more doors, more opportunities for you to grow as a person. You know, a lot of people don't know as much as they have in them, you know, and if they're true to themselves, you don't know what the world can open up to you, you know. And that's with my book, there's adventure, there's magic carpets, you know, there's a volcano scene, there's a scene on the ocean, it's very playful. It's whirlwinds, you know, and I use a lot of rhymes in the book because I want the kids, the rhymes are playful. Everyone loves rhymes. You know, they learn new words. It's exciting. It's humorous. And I think that's the best way to get people to feel comfortable and to get people to learn. Anytime you interject humor, but also, you know, in that is the sense that it's all about goodness. It's all about believing in yourself, listening to your heart, you know, and that's why these books are very playful, and they're on Amazon.com, and they're in ebook format. And the reason why I did that is because with the ebook formats, obviously you don't need to go out and buy a Kindle, you don't need to buy a Nook, because if you have a PC or a phone, you can download the applications for free. But in the Kindle and the ebook software, they're built in dictionaries. And everyone loves language, everyone loves words, and it's a great vocabulary builder. You know, I mean, that's one of the side benefits. There's a section in Petrino and the Gremlin Spies that's dedicated, kind of a homage to great people of society, whether that's J.D. Rockefeller, Steve Jobs, Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi. I've written a section, you know, it's just a rhyming section of what they've produced in society, you know, and I think that's very important. And if you study great people, you realize that they're not so much smarter than other people. They just followed their dreams and they stuck with it and they stuck on that straight line and they achieved great things. You know, no one is great right off the bat.
Yeah, but you've got to have a vision. I think we're all great right off the bat, but let me qualify that. We're great off the bat, but we don't recognize the greatness. We bury the greatness until such time as a door opens and we can maneuver through. You talked about rhythm. Rhythm has its own beat. It's got its own rhymes. I'm sorry, I said that backwards. Rhymes have their own rhythm. And rhythm in and of itself is a way to connect with people. That rhythm, when they feel that recognition kind of vibration, they don't know what it is, but it feels good. It is a way to move through all of the noise and all of those blocks that we face every day, all of the confusion, and to see that little light at the end of the tunnel. I think the majority of kids want what that is inside, but if you hit them right away and say, okay, goodness is there, and it's, yeah, sure, right. But if they can qualify what goodness is, if they can define what it is, define what all of those things that it takes for them to be the best they can be, they've got to be able to define it. When you define it, you can recognize it. And when you recognize it, you can use it practically.
And I wholeheartedly agree. And what you said is correct, and I guess I misspoke. When I say greatness doesn't just come, I believe people, everyone has an innate sense of greatness.
Sure.
But I'm saying that sometimes people naively think, oh, it just happens. Like, it comes through work and practice. But the thing is, when you're doing something you love, you don't even recognize it as work. You just do it over and over, and you become a perfectionist because you really want to do well just for yourself. So that was my point, that if you're following your bliss, you're going to work so hard for yourself because you love what you're doing and you want to do an excellent job. So like, getting to your back to your point about that, raising your self-esteem and basically solidifying you as a very productive person, that's what we all want in life.
Sure. And if you go to the schools today with that tremendous dropout percentage that we see all over the place, and it's big. That's because the schools don't have the values that the kids are looking for, whatever they are. That's where the problem is. If there was value in the schools for the kids, if they really felt they were getting something out of it, if they really felt they were participating and becoming part of it, you'd see everybody graduating. There'd be very few people dropping out. But right now, the schools aren't holding whatever it is that's going to take those kids to stay there, find a value, and make it part of their life.
Well, and I think you bring up a very good point. I taught for 2 years when I first graduated from college in an inner city. And the thing is, I understand that certain requirements are necessary, but you bring up a great point that basically a lot of times the schools are out of touch. Like, kids, everything is immediate, and everything is fast now. And kids want things that are practical. You know, if they had maybe courses on how to become a brain surgeon, obviously it's not medical school, but it would give kids into the insight of being a brain surgeon or a mechanical engineer, you know, or other various professions, an architect, where kids can kind of see a practical application. They could obviously have professionals come in and discuss what they do, and then the kids could kind of see the relevancy and the necessity of taking these fundamental core courses, whether it's chemistry, whether it's trigonometry. But I think with kids now, they have to kind of see, okay, well, I'm taking this course, chemistry, but what am I taking it for? You know, okay, well, you want to be a doctor, you want to be a pharmacist. I think if the school systems introduced practical courses dealing with occupations, I think that would generate so much interest, you know. And like I'm sorry about that.
No, go ahead. That's great.
And what I think the kids and people now have at their disposal now is one of the greatest inventions that's ever been, and that's Google. And anyone can get on Google and find out what a mechanical engineer does, what a brain surgeon does, you know, what a heart surgeon does. You could go on YouTube. You could look at files. The thing is, if a person finds something that they're passionate about or just inquisitive about, you can find so much information. I mean, these kids, they're like sponges. So I think that needs to be encouraged. And to your point, that would drastically decrease the dropout rates and the apathy in schools.
Oh, no question. PG, we're running out of time now. Do you have a website we can find you at? We can buy the book and get more information.
Okay. You can. I have a Facebook page. It's PG Callahan at Facebook. And if you go to www.amazon.com, you can Petrino and the World Underneath, book one is on there now. And by Monday, Petrino and the Gremlin Spies, book two will be on there. And they're $6.99 and $7.99. They're great books. I mean, I'm not just saying them because they're my books. There's a lot of goodness, a lot of love, a lot of fun. It's something totally unique.
I hear you loud and
not
clear.
Not to do my homework.
No, I know, PG, we got to go, but I'm pretty sure Radio Susie's got that information, and we'll have it up on our website in case somebody missed it. Hey, nice job on this, and thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you very much, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free anytime if you want to join in, 888-429-5471. Chris Graves with us, co-author of The Innovative Team, Unleashing Creative Potential for Breakthrough Results. He's an organizational and leadership development consultant focused on increasing the creative capacity of individuals, teams, and organizations. His clients have included Ernst & Young, Connecticut Children's Medical Center, and the New York University, among others. He holds a master's degree in creativity from the International Center for Studies in Creativity in Buffalo, New York. His book, The Innovative Team, offers new tools for creative problem solving for teams and team leaders or anyone who wants to kickstart innovation in their workplace or in their lives. And let's say, Chris, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It was a great introduction.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we're really dealing with teams today, I would venture to guess even teams in the past, there's a structure. There is a step 1, 2, 3, and 4. If you want to be a team, teams just don't happen. And I really believe that if you take a look and you look underneath what you think you see, you find out what's missing. And usually what's missing is that commonality of focus on the goal that they're going after. And with that, let me throw it over to you, because when you created the book, The Innovative Team, what did you find missing?
Well, one of the things that I found missing was that when teams start out, they rarely do any reflection time. They don't spend time figuring out what their road path is, who's around the table, where are the strengths that the people are bringing to the table. and figuring out, okay, what's the next step? How are we going to proceed moving forward? Most teams just dive into the work without any reflection. And that's where I'm hoping my book will really make a difference, because it gives people a framework for understanding the thinking styles of the people around the table and then gives them tools to help them work together.
Now, isn't that critical when we really talk about the thinking styles of the people around the table? You can say a word, and that doesn't necessarily mean those people sitting around the table understand the, not so much the definition, but the connotation of the word coming from you. You can say the word gun, and you can have five people in the room with completely different definitions and walk away with four or five different messages and lose maybe two-thirds of the people at the table. So I think that in and of itself, the communication is one thing, but the focusing on the goal, I think that's probably where strategies don't happen and you have to create the strategy, because you may have those quote-unquote five people sitting around the table with a completely different definition of what the goal is.
I think that's a good point. A matter of fact, one of the measure that's associated with my book is called Foresight, and you can find it on foresightonline.com. And what it shows is that there's four different thinking styles that people use when they're solving problems. And the thing is that we approach the problem we solve through that lens. And what I've found through conducting a lot of leadership development programs using this tool is that you may hear one thing from one person, like be direct. If you want to communicate with me, be direct. Well, if you're a clarifying type, that's going to mean one thing, and if you're an ideating type, that's going to mean something completely different. So your example with the gun is right on. People need to first, though, come up with an understanding of each other's lenses, and then you can focus on strategy really effectively.
Okay, so let's put it to the practical example scenario. I have a team of four or five people. We don't know that that problem exists that we just talked about. You come in to consult. What's that first step? How do you get us to get balance and common definition for our goals?
What I'd like to do first is start off talking about where do we want to head? So to your point about strategy, where's the end result? And then map out the steps to getting there. And then, looking at that, I often find that they either will have completed all the steps that we know are involved in creativity and problem solving, or they may be stronger or weaker in different areas. And that's where, as a facilitator, I can bring them the tools to get them over the hump when they run into places that nobody is really strong or places they want to gloss over. Or I can pull back the reins if they're all too deep into it, doing something they really like, but they're not moving forward.
Well, what I think a lot of the teams miss, and you talk about this in your press release, I see the word, it's so important, it's the how-tos, the practical steps to get there. You know, we hear so much information constantly, but what we really need is somebody to hold us by the hand, take us through step by step, and then make the corrections until we finally got it right. Because when you really come down to it, you can strategize and be the most brilliant business person in the world, but if you don't have the roadmap to get there, you're going to have problems.
Right. Well, that's actually one of the reasons I wrote the book as a business fable. The first three quarters of the book is really telling a story of a team that's having trouble and needs to turn itself around, and then what a really skillful leader does to take them through the whole process. So you can see the step-by-step methods that she uses and the process she takes, and how along the way there's a lot of self-discovery going on within the team that helps them be more effective, appreciate the diversity of thinking styles that are on the team, and help them accomplish something really great. Then
now,
the
by
last
the way,
quarter of the book is
oh,
really...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, the last quarter of the book is talking about the theory about what you just read. Clearly defines. This is the universal creative process. These are the steps that you would go through. And here's even some tools you can use if you have trouble with those steps.
I think one of the most important things also, and when you're talking about thinking styles, obviously they're different, but also your target audience, your customer, your client, your patient, whoever it's going to be, also thinks differently than most of the people that are presenting. And it's organizing yourself to a point where you can match the style of that audience of yours. And if you got different thinking styles within the team, those styles are very important in reaching that audience or those people that you're trying to reach that have those same exact styles. So it's great to be able to balance, but at the same time, use the individual styles to reach those people out there that most of the team can't.
Right. And what in order to do that, you're responsible for your own communication. So if you want your message to get across to those people, you have to understand where they're coming from. So you have to be able to recognize the lens that they're seeing you with. And for doing that, you need a framework. You need some sort of structure in mind that you can use to help identify where people are strong and then be able to alter your own communication style to them so that they can really hear what you have to say and be able to move through the process.
Now, by the way, when businesses get a hold of this, do you find resistance? And when I say do you find resistance, obviously there are people who I'm fighting with a cat. She's winning. She got the microphone. Obviously there are going to be people who bring you in to set the program up. But how do you overcome the resistance of some of those people that are in the training process that are frightened of change? And I think that's what happens when you get into organizations and you've got more than 3 or 4 or 5 people you're working with. There are those people, again, frightened of change. And you've got to be able to move through in such a way that they realize that this will work and they're still part of the team, quote unquote.
You know, I think that the challenge is really there up front in the contracting with the group. You want to make sure you're clear about expectations and that you constantly are resetting those as you're moving forward so that everybody's on the same page. But that's a consulting model, really. The thing that I've found out is when I'm doing this type of training with folks, when we're examining the framework and we're experiencing what the creative process is, I don't find a lot of resistance there. People seem to be pretty open to it, and they're learning a lot about themselves, and people like to do that. Where you find the resistance is more at the end, because often organizations ask for something creative or say they want to make innovation a core competency, and they're not really prepared for what they get, and that's where the change comes in. Because all innovation is change, and hopefully it's positive change, but it's novelty, and that can be unnerving. So at the very beginning, I'd like to make sure that we've got something set up to catch the novelty, to really examine it, to make it safe, and then do the change management necessary for implementing it well.
What is that uniqueness about the program in and of itself? What makes it stand out, quote-unquote, from the crowd?
The measure that we're using is one that is very different from other psychological instruments like, say, Myers-Briggs, which is very popular, or DISC, or some others, in that those measures measure who you are outside of context, who you are generally. What Foresight measures is who you are, is how you think when you're engaging in problem solving. So it puts you in the context of using your creativity, and therefore it's much more focused on task at hand. And it's also focused on how the team works together. And some of the added benefit of not only learning about yourself and having the framework to understand others is if you do it as a team, you can see where in the team you tend to fall. If you have a lot of people that are all of similar type, you might be more likely to fall into the trap of groupthink faster than if you have a group that's full of diversity of thought. Yeah. If you have enough folks that are of diverse areas, then the challenge becomes how do you keep those people engaged who are not strong at certain areas through the entire process. So it's a measure that's really focused on the product at the end. It's focused on helping people get to something. And you don't find a lot of that.
You know, interestingly enough, I found over the years also that the word problem, very interesting word. How many times do you find yourself personally, you walk into a group and quote-unquote everybody's focusing on the problem, but you've got different definition of what the problem is, and they're not moving in the same direction. They have no idea what it is that they're really going after.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that's the very first stage in the whole creative process, which is clarifying, where you examine the problem or the challenge or the situation, whatever you want to call it, whatever the mess is that you're dealing with. You look at all the data that's relevant, that can help you understand the whole problem space, if you will, and then you examine all the different possible directions you can head and then converge on the one or two that are really going to make the difference and maybe get you a an innovative result as by going that way.
By the way, Chris, the reason
that's the first stage of the process.
The reason I think what you have today, you know, the innovative team, is so critically important because look at what's going on in this culture today. There's so much diverse thinking of what's right, what's wrong. We don't have anything that anybody can grab onto solidly. And with the with the financial confusion that we are in and all of the mixed messages that we get and we just get numb to it after a while, that people are often wrong track. So what I think that you've got here is something that will allow businesses to stay, quote unquote, focused. And I love the quote unquote because we've got to emphasize that, but to stay, keep them focused and all on the same page moving forward, everybody wanting the same end result. That is missing in so many businesses today because of all of these external influences.
That's right. That's a great point. I would love to see more of that. You know, one of the other things that occurred to me as you were talking there about things that make it unique is a lot of times when people are asking for creativity, and you look in the literature and like your average bookstore, you'll find most of it's focused on just coming up with a new idea. And what you end up with is a lot of ideas about a lot of different things, and nobody's and again, you're not focused on the goal. So if you have a process where you realize, hey, you know, generating those ideas is only one quarter of the whole creative process, let's take it all the way through. I'd like to see people in government do it, to your point there. I think we'd be a lot better off if we're all focused on the right
Chris,
things.
I would love to see government do this right now because of the confusion, and I really believe that a great example, forgetting left, right, Republican, Democrat, but I really believe a great example, if you walked into a business and you would say, why do you think this would work? Just say, imagine it implemented in the government today. That's all you really need to do the final the final message. Because realistically, it is. It's, you know, and what you're talking about here is having the goal is having the entire group in mind. And I think that's really where the key is. When you start to get to a point where everybody is focusing, everybody's together, everybody's vested in the end result, now we're talking common goals, sharing common means to get there. And I think that's what we're missing in the country right now.
Well, actually, to name a government institution where they actually do it and do it well, you just look at the military.
Yeah.
They are focused on a common goal. They need to come up with innovative solutions. As a matter of fact, the military right now is leading the way in green technology. So they're doing something right.
No, absolutely. No question about it. We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Can we get a website where we can find you, find out what you're doing, and also buy the book?
Best place to go to buy the book would be Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. The best place to look for me and the measure, Foresight, is ForesightOnline.com. And a matter of fact, you can take a quick demo of it for free on there, see what your dominant preference is, and then if you want, you can go and explore the other products and see if you want to explore it further.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I love what you've got, and I hope everybody takes advantage of it because we need something like this in today's world.
Well, thank you so much, Mike.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
You're going to miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I'd do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby,
when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Irene McGoldrick with us. She became a widow and a single parent at the age of 36 when her husband died after a heroic fight with cancer. She went on to write two Chai Day, One Widow's Story About Living Beyond Grief, a book about her late husband's death and her march through mourning, determined to embrace her grief with intention. She's also a social worker, speaker, massage therapist, and essential oil expert. Let's say, Irene, I welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank Hello. You so much. And, yeah, hi, and thank you so much for being here. You know, most people really don't know how to deal with grief. It takes someone who's been there, who's done that, and gone through the process to really talk to anybody who is anywhere near going through that process. So let's start with you. Before you wrote the book, obviously it had to be devastating when you lost your husband. But what were the steps that you went through to get to where you are now?
Well, it was 8 years ago, so I've been through many steps to get here. But I went through some traditional steps and some non-traditional steps. And I think what made most of my grieving different from a lot of people's is I just really wanted to experience it as opposed to moving on, which is, I think, what a lot of people in our society want to do, just move on in general. So I felt like I wanted to really feel the grief in order to then be able to purge it and then move forward.
Okay, so, I guess it's the difference. I mean, I guess it's the difference, and stop me if I'm wrong here. It's the difference between moving on or moving with. And I think there would be more power with moving with, because then you're not burying it, because if you bury it, it's going to come back at you and bite you. It could be 50 years later.
Absolutely. And you don't want it biting you 50 years later, or 10, 15, any time later. So yes, I think that's very true. For me, it was more of a fact of moving forward rather than moving on. And I know it's just a matter of semantics, possibly, but for me it was a big difference, as opposed to sort of, I wanted to incorporate it in my life, my experience, and then move forward with the experience, as opposed to, you know, leaving it behind and moving on.
And now, by the way, there's another thing too, which you bring up. I've got your press release in front of me. There should be a book. There should be a book for people who know people who are going through grief, and the book should be a guideline of how to speak to someone who's going through the process. You don't know. You're not feeling it, and most of the time, you're frightened to death of what you're going to say.
Yes, because you don't want to say the wrong thing, and also I think that people just want to make the person feel better because they are trying to project how it must feel to be in their situation, and they feel like they can't imagine what it would be like, and they just want the person to feel better. And I think people are so uncomfortable with, you know, crying or emotions of those type, and they just want to say the right thing so that the person feels better. And so often the right thing is maybe not the right thing for that particular person. You know, it might be the right person. It might be the right thing for the person who's saying it, but it's not necessarily the right thing for the person who's hearing it.
No question.
It's just a very difficult thing. I think less is more when you're talking to somebody who's grieving.
And I would venture to guess that one of the problems that you run into are people are afraid of you now. when I say afraid of you, if it can happen to you, quote unquote, it can happen to me. And a lot of the shying away from you, whoever the you might be, a lot of the shying mm-hmm. away from you, a lot of the holding back and not talking to you is their own fear. It's projection. Projection had nothing to do with you, but those are some of the things that you have to face out there. They're not shying away from you because you're you, or it's your fault or any of those other reasons that go along with it.
Right.
They're scared.
No. Exactly. I mean, it's not personal. It's just that I represent everybody's kind of worst nightmare. And I know I've had that circumstance with, you know, people since my husband's death where they've possibly had a diagnosis. And I feel like I walk into the room and I represent to them their worst case scenario and absolutely feel that kind of fear or just, you know, not wanting to see it so in their face, you know, represented right there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's nothing personal. It's just people's fear of the unknown and...
There's also rules of the road in general.
There's
rules of the road. I'm going to touch on something that you've said. There's the over-sympathizing. There's where a problem can be. I mean, there's some definite no-nos, things you don't do. But again, I'm going to go back to how do you know what to do or what not to do if you're not in that situation? But the oversympathizing can be a real problem because then it's almost like you're being talked down to or you're a child or a something.
Yes, absolutely. And I know other widows that I have talked to, they talk about the head tilt, you know, the head tilt when people hear about your situation and that you don't want to be pitied for your situation. You know, because it's nothing to be pitied for. It's a tragedy that you're going to move through and nothing anybody could do about it, but you're just going to make the best of it, you know? So the old saying, as far as you can't choose your cards you're dealt, but you can, you know, play them the best that you can. So yeah, you don't want to be pitied, I think, is the over sympathy.
And when also
you don't
happens,
want people feeling bad for you.
Sure, and I imagine what happens to you in a case like that, too. There's a sense of losing your dignity. You know, you built a world, you built an identity around another person, you built a life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of a sudden, the life isn't there. There is that lacking within inside of you that another person filled for you, and it's got to be very hard to go through life now as a piece of a person, quote-unquote.
Oh, absolutely. And I think for me, I had always felt like such an independent person. I was independent and we were an independent couple. And I was shocked at how dependent I had become on him. That things that I didn't even realize, I mean, stupid things, like I didn't even know where the vacuum cleaner bags were kept, you know, and I didn't realize that until after he died. You don't realize, you know, how much another person becomes a part of your life and does things for you, even though you think you're a very independent person. And I think absolutely you have to re-identify yourself and sort of rebuild your life and realize that you're still, you are a strong person and that it's all going to incorporate into something stronger, actually. But you do become a different person, and that's part of the grieving, too, is that you'll never be the person that you were. You know, you become a different person. And, of course, you liked, well, not everybody, but most of you liked the person that you were before and the person that you were with that person. And so you don't, that's part of the hard part of letting it go, because you need to let go of that person and decide who you want to be from now on.
Sure. And there's another area of consideration also. Grief is not restricted to someone dying. You can be in a relationship. You can be a very powerful relationship. The relationship breaks up. That's almost like somebody mm-hmm. dying. You know, you've got really the same thing. And the process,
absolutely.
Any way you look at it, the process mm-hmm. is the same.
Yes, grieving, absolutely. I mean, I've heard people talk about a divorce being a walking death. In some ways, I think it can be harder because there's not that finality to it. And absolutely, you go through the grieving process, you know, losing a job or moving or any number of griefs that we go through our life. Absolutely, it doesn't have to be losing someone through death.
No, sure. Time and again, I've heard people say over the years, based on this particular scenario we're talking about, that it would be easier if somebody died then have to go through the process of the divorce and the rest of it. And that's not necessarily wishing death on anybody, but it is that process. It's that process. Now you've got your wacky widows club. Now, how did that get created?
Yes. Actually, I infiltrated the Wacky Widows Club a couple years into it, and it was created by the internet, is how it was created. A group of women found each other through the internet, someone who knew somebody who wanted to connect another person, and it's this group of women who are, we started out all 30, 40 and under, and now we're all creeping into our 40s, and we had all lost a husband. We all had young children. And we all just bonded because of the commonalities of what we had. It was so freeing to be able to sit in a room and talk with women about, you know, Social Security issues or any issues, you know, that you couldn't talk with other friends about. And it just felt really comfortable and so supportive for the kids to also be with other kids who had lost parents. I know sometimes that can feel very isolating for the children, and it was just serendipitous how all these women were in like a 20-minute drive of each other, and they used to get together weekly, but now it gets harder now that the kids are older and people are, you know, in new relationships and moving forward with their lives. But it has certainly been just so important in everybody's healing and just a serendipitous situation that everybody found each other.
No, and how
and everybody's husbands died different ways, and you know.
Sure. Now, by the way, how do you, when you meet someone new, how do you do that without carrying forward your late husband?
Yeah, that's actually very difficult for me to do, because I do find myself wanting people to know the situation. You know, like if you mention your kids or something like that, or having stepchildren, I feel like I want them to know that my first husband died, and not that I'm divorced. I'm not exactly sure what drives my need for people to understand that, but I do definitely, it seems to come up, you know, rather quickly in a conversation that,
sure,
that my husband passed away. And well, I feel that that's important for some reason.
Okay, and if it is, in one way, shape, or form, when they die, they're never gone, and I think that's realistic.
They're never gone. No, his spirit is very much still with us, and absolutely, he is. You know, I am married again now, and he is sort of part of all of our merged family now. So, you know, my stepchildren talk about him almost as freely as my own children do, and he just sort of seems a part of the family still.
Oh, but absolutely, because if you really love someone, and if you have that kind of a relationship, and that if you were to die, you wouldn't want that person to live their life completely alone for the rest of their lives.
No, absolutely not. I would not want anyone pining for me, or, you know, being sad or feeling like they couldn't, you know, move forward with a different relationship. No, I wouldn't want that. I wouldn't want that. My late husband would have never wanted that either, and he would have never wanted, you know, our boys to, you know, grow up without a male figure in their life and that kind of thing.
Oh, I no question about it. And by the way, and I really believe if you really have it complete, that doesn't mean that you've forgotten them, you don't think about it. But when you have it complete, when you're able to neutralize the negative effect of what went on, then life can go on, and life can go on in such a way that it's okay to live. It's okay to meet someone else. It's okay to be. Nobody's ever going to replace them. It's not going to happen.
No.
But at the same time, there's a completely different type of a love that you feel and you run into, and it's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, it's all good. And you can't imagine that it would ever happen initially when you're just in the, you know, active throes of grieving, but absolutely you can be in a relationship. I mean, you're a different person, so the relationship is different, obviously. But I know that is something that people often struggle with, though. People who have not lost a spouse, they're confused by how frequently or how comfortably Bob's name will come up in our house, and we have pictures of him, and they imagine that that must be very difficult for my live husband, as we refer to him. But I don't think that it is, and I don't think that there's any reason why his picture shouldn't be up. He's the father of my children, and
sure.
You know, if it was a divorce situation, it would be different, but they would also then see their father.
Oh, sure.
You know,
and I think
hopefully.
One of the most important things that can happen for a person when something like this to any degree comes up, Irene, I think what we really are dealing with is you need a support group. There's your Wacky Widows Club. If you don't have the support group, who knows what will happen to you? But you've got people who understand. You've got people who can relate to you. You have people that if you say, I don't know how to handle a checkbook or pay a bill, they'll say, oh, do it this way. And it's okay because it's a peer group and nobody is condescending, judging you, or looking down. Everybody's in there to support and move forward.
Absolutely. And everybody just understands. You don't need to explain anything. And I think that the internet has been a really, really important piece for young widows in particular. And when I talk about young widows, I probably mean 60 and under. And I think the internet has been just so fabulous in bringing people together, because it is still a very small percentage of the population that are widowed young like that. And there's a lot of us out there, but we might spread out a little bit. So I think the internet has been very helpful in bringing people together and providing support for widows and widowers that might not have been available before the internet. So I think that's a really important piece.
Oh, absolutely.
To bring together.
It's called support, and you've got to have those places that you can go to get the information that you want to get. And I really believe the groups, whether it's divorce, whether it's there's death, or if you're an accounting group, you know, it's just that, mm-hmm. that those groups that have the same common goals, that you know that you can pick up a phone or go once a week where there's no judgment, and you can come in, and if you got a problem, you got a problem, because they've had it before, and at least they know how to anticipate and move you through it.
Absolutely. Everybody just understands each other and is just there to help each other. And I think that's really important.
No question. Now, we're about out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, you can. www.ms-dh.com.
Okay. And by the way, if it went too fast, it'll be up on our website so people can find you through us if they need to do so. By the way, thank you so much for joining us. And anybody from Wisconsin can't be all that bad.
That's absolutely right. We're good people here.
By the way,
you know
where we're broadcasting from?
I actually don't know where you're broadcasting from. You're broadcasting from Milwaukee?
How about Mequon? Yeah.
Mequon.
Yes.
Yeah, so Mequon. You're good people in Mequon, too.
So if we yell loud enough, you'll probably hear us. Hey, by the way, thank you
probably.
So much.
Probably.
Take care.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
You'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call
my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true and a hand that I can hold.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 1-888-429-5471, if you want to join in. Fred Gleick with us. He is the author of Sell Your Brain Power, Information Marketing in 7 Easy Steps. He's been creating and marketing information for over 25 years now. He's developed well over 1,000 audios, videos, books, ebooks for himself and his clients. He is the author of over 20 books, including Marketing and Promoting Your Own Seminars, Workshops, and Speaking for Millions. He coaches a select group of people on how to use his patented system and techniques. Fred, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me, but I'm nowhere near the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, that's I'm going to yell back and forth. By the way, where are you?
I am in sunny Southern California.
Oh, where about? I'm in old California. I was brought up and raised in Southern California. As a matter of fact,
yeah, I read that on your bio.
I came from the most famous city in Southern California. Famous. You ready for this?
That would be Hollywood.
No, no. It would be Bell, California. Because nowhere else in Southern California is the mayor going to jail, the chief of police going to jail, and they were having, incomes of $500,000, $750,000 a year. So that happened about a year ago. So I'm coming from the most famous place in Southern California.
Yeah, we're both in the wrong profession. We should have been in city council.
You got that one right. Hey, by the way, Sell Your Brain Power, Information Marketing in 7 Easy Steps. The operative word is information. Everybody's got some kind of information, but it's the application of the information is really where the key is. And Fred, I would venture to guess that most people have no concept, no idea how to apply. Take what you've got already and get it out there and market it.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, there are a ton of anybody, any of your listeners out there have something that they know that they can probably almost certainly turn into cash.
No, no question about it. As a matter of fact, I think really what we're talking about here, too, is I'm going to go through a little bit of a round robin here. It goes all the way back to mom and pops. Mom and pops were everybody loved them. Everybody patted. They patted you on the back when you walked in. They knew you, your dog, and your family. And then corporations came in and kind of drove mom and pop out. They couldn't compete. So corporations were doing fine. Yep. And then we went global. We went international. And now all of a sudden the competition got too much for the corporations and they outsourced. So where did the people go that were outsourcing? They became the mom and pops again. They went home, got a hold of their computers, and they became entrepreneurs. And I think that in and of itself is the key. There's so many people out there with so much information, stuff that somebody else is just dying to get a hold of that they can make money on.
I cannot disagree with you at all.
Okay, let's take a step. Let's take information. What do we do? How do we start with doing this with what you're talking about?
First thing, Michael, that you need to do is obviously you need to get a hold of and sort of get a pen and paper and ask yourself, what is it that you know a lot about, that you know more than, say, 90% of the people out there? You don't have to be the definitive expert in the world, but I want people to take an inventory of what they know. I mean, it could be something as mundane as, you know, how to put a fish on a fish hook to go fishing. I don't know what it is. I've heard stories about a guy who made, you know, literally over a couple $100,000 with his having figured out how to put a bird feeder up outside his breakfast nook. So you have a lot of knowledge if you're listening to this program right now. You're listening and you're saying to yourself, well, what would I have? And the answer is, let's get all of those ideas out on paper. So I don't care if it's about quilting or about your, you know, knowing how to hit a golf ball straight, but you know probably 3 or 4 or 5 things better than 90% of the people on the planet. That's where you need to start, is an inventory.
By the way, a close friend of mine and a business associate, I think it's his nephew, loved sushi. The family loved sushi, and they decided they wanted to do it at home, but it was too sloppy, it was too expensive, and whatever. So he was doing what you're talking about. He invented a sushi machine where somebody can use at home. It was inexpensive to make, it was clean to take care of, and he's making money from it. And it's exactly what you're talking about. Somebody has an idea. That's what this country was built on. It was built on a concept, an innovative, an idea, and that idea that they manifested into something that was tangible and workable. And what we're really saying is, let's put to use what got us to where we were as an economy.
Yeah, man, I would agree. The only thing I would comment on regarding the guy with the sushi machine is this. I would go even a step further, which is, you know, producing a sushi machine means he has to put out money for inventory, et cetera. What about if he were to put out some kind of a manual or a video showing people how to make their own sushi machine? Then he could sell that knowledge and information without actually having to sell the physical unit and not have to worry about inventory or overhead or cost.
Yeah, and by the way, that's what is that called? It's called sleeping and making money at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, great. No, I think it's a phenomenal idea. And why not take advantage of the internet today? And when I say take advantage of it, it's there if you know how to use it. And look at all of those sites out there, the Facebook, Twitter, and I mean, the list goes on. They're there if you know how to use them. Most people, Fred, have no idea how to use them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one of the things that I always talk to people about, whether I'm, you know, it's in one of the books that I've written or at a seminar that I give, is that an understanding of how to do this. And again, I'm not in my 20s. Let's suffice it to say I'm over 40 by about 15 years, by the way. And given that fact, I realized that the internet and the use of the web was going to be extremely important. So I said, you know, let me figure out how to do this. And what I have figured out is any of your listeners who take these ideas that they have between their ears right now, using the internet, using Facebook, Twitter, and some of these other tools, can create a business from their homes. And I'm not going to tell them they can make $1 million in 90 days, but they can certainly make a car payment, you know, in a few months, or maybe even, you know, a mortgage payment a few more months after that. It's very possible for anybody listening.
And I think it's one of the things that's very important that, and Fred, when somebody gets into this, there's a word that frightens everybody that is not in the world of their own business. It's called selling, okay? People are frightened to death of that word, and I can't tell you how many times, and I'm sure you run into the same thing. I can't sell anything. I don't know how to do it, et cetera. And they just don't have a handle on what selling really means and marketing really means. All it is offer and acceptance. And when they get that in their head, then it's okay to do. You say sales, the first image somebody gets is selling a $100 used car that doesn't work, and you're going to grab the money and run. That is not selling. And I really believe that there's an entire education behind it, and it's okay. Selling is an okay thing to do.
Yeah, and not only that, but I think when people bring up selling, they think of a door-to-door salesperson. And now, with the internet and with a very well-constructed website, you can have your website selling for you. So once you set it up, it essentially, and all of my sites, do the selling for me, which is a whole lot better than knocking on doors.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And I think we've come a long way from knocking on doors. And if you have the process, if you have, Fred, if you've got somebody holding you by the hand and saying, this is step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 steps. How's that? You get to the 7 steps. Pretty soon you got a feel doing it by yourself. But you need somebody who's been there, done that, fallen down, got back up, found the right way to do it, fall down again, and keep on going until you've got it created in such a way that the 20-some-odd years that you've been in this, somebody can take advantage of that, read the book, take 2-3 hours, and they can anticipate the problems before they came up, and they don't have to go through all of it.
Absolutely. And the other thing, Michael, that's interesting is that I'm not saying that once somebody uses my system and tries it and does it, you know, 3 or 4 different times, that they can't start to improvise. But with anything, when you don't know exactly what you're doing, it's better to follow a tested and tried and true system until you figure out how to use it. And then you can start to do your own thing and improvise a little bit. But first start with somebody who's done it before, who knows how to do it, follow their lead.
Yeah, no question about it. And I really think that's what we need. And in today's world, especially, there was a time when somebody was going to apply for a job. There might have been three or four people applying for the same job. You're up against 10,000 people now if you want to go out and find a job. So what's the alternative? The alternative is be creative. The one thing that this country was that they can't take away from us was our innovation, our manufacturing. The rest of it may have taken a little bit of a hit, but we've always been innovative, and that's the one thing that will cause us to move ahead. So it's called There Is a Way to Do It. And if somebody says the economy is bad enough or there's no money out there, I totally and completely disagree. For the right thing, money is there. We talk about an 8.5-something unemployment rate, but what about the 90-some-odd percent of the people that are working? All we're hearing is fear, 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 fear. What I'm hearing you say is there's something that can take you beyond that, that you don't have to worry about all of these messages that you're getting, and you can be independent, go out and make some money.
Absolutely, no doubt. And again, in an economy like this, any of your listeners who are either, you know, they've been downsized or now they're working less hours, this is a way to using the tools that they already have to take that knowledge and to turn it into some cash, which everybody, you know, in this day and age needs. So, it can be done full-time or part-time, and I would encourage anybody to really look into the concept of selling information and selling knowledge.
Yeah, and that's really what it is. And there was a time that I thought, well, you know, there's so many things that have been invented so far, and nothing is any more than a derivative of something else. I disagree with that today. My own thought I disagree with, because there are the thing, you know, the sushi machine and all of these different things that you've got in your head. And somehow, if you've thought of it, somewhere somebody is going to want to take advantage of it and use it. And with the ability that we have to reach people today, Fred, my goodness, sometimes I have to sit back and it's totally mind-boggling of the volume of people if you could reach. And if you have the right product and the right way to communicate it, my goodness, you don't have to do anything else.
No doubt. No disagreement here.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let me ask you this. For you, where was it that you got the, you know, that cathartic moment that said, this is something that can work. This is something that will work for everybody.
Yeah. Well, I've done a little research on you, Michael, and I know you like stories. So here's my story. After having been fired from the fifth major U.S. corporation, Fortune 500 corporation, I sort of figured out that I should, you know, probably pursue the self-employment route. There seemed to be unanimous agreement I should be self-employed.
Yeah.
So what I did was I sort of took my knowledge, which was, you know, I had gotten all kinds of credentials in business academically, but I knew a lot of things, you know, I had some skills other than that, and I tried to mesh those both academic and sort of self-generated skills. And I came up with, and I did my first sort of open to the public seminar on how to create and run your own consulting business. And so my story was, after having been fired five times, I said, you know, I've got to find a way. And so I took my background. I was going to, originally my parents wouldn't pay for me to get my degree in theater. They said, you know, if you want to do that, you pay for it yourself. So in an attempt to stay in beer money in college, I majored in business, and I said to myself after getting out of college, I got to find a way to mix and mesh these two things, which is a business background with a theater and performing interest. So I came up with doing business theater, business seminars, if you will, and I figured out a few things, you know, actually wrote the book on how to market and promote your own seminars and workshops. And so what I realized, though, is from watching all of these seminar leaders and speakers who were out there, the guys that were doing the best in terms of making the most money, the guys and gals, had a lot of stuff to sell, and that stuff was the information products we're talking about here, which is packaged knowledge, whether it be audio, video, books, knowledge that is packaged, how-to information. So that's how I came to this business many years ago.
And by the way, I wonder how many people have gone through that kind of a process. You know, you get into something, it's not working out, you get into something else, and all of a sudden the combination of those different things all of a sudden come together. And then the light bulb goes on, and then you move forward. That's when the emotional connection takes place, and what you really want is there. I think it's the recognition of what you didn't know was there before. It's something that you always have, but it takes somebody like yourself to point to somebody and say, look at what you have inside. And all of a sudden, we look at this foundation that's caused us to make the kind of decisions that we make, and there's more there than we thought was there. And what I'm hearing you say, it's what you're talking about is something practical, not beyond the reach of anybody who wants to do something like this.
Yeah, it's funny, because when I titled the book, Spell Your Brain Power, I tried to communicate the idea that basically anyone can do this. And I really mean anyone, because I've seen people with extremely diverse interests and knowledge that have taken this system and had a go with it. I mean, there's a guy who's using the system who's a state senator in Washington. There's also a gal, who does fitness training. You know, there's a guy in Chicago who does voiceover work. I mean, this is the number of different people and different professions involved in using this exact system that I've created is unbelievable. I'm always amazed by the different types of people. There's a gal who came to one of my events who was into showing people how to create their own log homes, how to build their own log cabin homes. Fascinating.
No, absolutely. That's the key. And let me tell you what I believe the power of the story is. As you're talking and as you're saying, you know, there was this person who did that and that person who did this and this person who did that, there's where the recognition comes from. And I wonder how many people out there listening right now are saying, oh, I can do that. Oh, there's something close that I have. And I think that's really where the key is. You know, we can hear quote unquote information all the time, but I'll go right back to where we started. It's the use of the information, the application of the knowledge. Somebody once said knowledge is power. I totally disagree. It's the application of the knowledge where the real power is. Otherwise, it's sitting there, it's laying dormant, and not doing anybody any good. You can have an idea that might even be life-saving, so who knows? But Fred, we're just about out of time. Website, we can find you, we can find the books, and get all the different information.
Yeah, it's sellyourbrainpower.com. So sellyourbrainpower.com, or anybody can go on Amazon and look for the book, Sell Your Brain Power, available in both a physical book form and also in a Kindle book form for those people who like and use e-readers. So Sell Your Brain Power, either directly at .com or through Amazon.
Wonderful. And by the way, before we finish the night, I've been on your mailing list for years.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hey, Fred, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it and love what you're doing.
Michael, thank you for your time.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Some of these days you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jessica Simcoe with us. The upcoming book, Why Can't I Be Me? And we have a contributing author to the book also. She's a contributing author to the book, 101 Great Ways to Enhance Your Career. Radio Susie just threw something at me and said, I did it right. I promise I did. Okay. Jessica is a personal and a career branding strategist, job search expert in her individual working in the corporate and work environment. Previously, she was a senior-level human resources professional with 15 years' experience in recruiting, hiring, staffing, and career development management. And she has an in-depth industry knowledge, a unique perspective, and a deep passion for helping individuals find permanent solutions to their job search and career struggles by helping them to understand and integrate what it really takes to be successful in the corporate work environment. Jessica, hi, welcome to the show. Jessica, do we have you?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there we go. Okay, I got you.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's all right. Somehow we had a little sound blip, but we're good to go now, and thank goodness I've got you. You know, realistically, I want to look at the subtitle of the book because it really says a lot. Or not so much the subtitle, but the title, Why Can't I Be Me? I wonder how many people are frightened to death to say this is who I am when they go into a job. Because what I found over the years in all the interviews that I've done is that a job interview is two ways. Not only are they interviewing you, but you better be interviewing them too to make sure that there's a right fit. So the question is, why do we find ourselves hiding and not showing up as to who we are in a job interview?
Well, what typically happens in a job interview is that most people tend to go out on the internet and they get books and they read articles and they try to figure out, you know, how do I do this right? How do I interview correctly so I can actually get a job offer out of it? And so in doing that, and even some people go further with that and get a coach, they learn what exactly they're supposed to say. They learn, you know, this is what you should say, this is what you should do, this is the things that they're looking for you to say, this is how they want you to be. And so they go into the interview and they have to do those things and they say those things. And there's a lot of questions that get asked of candidates, such as, you know, what is your greatest weakness? That's a very common question. And if your greatest weakness is that you procrastinate or you're very disorganized or, you know, just something that puts you in a negative light, you can't honestly say that. You have to say the right thing. So you can't really present yourself as who you are.
You know, realistically, I think I've applied for two jobs in my entire life. And the last time I applied for a job was probably, I don't even tell you how many years ago it was, a long, long time ago. But I remember thinking in the two jobs that I interviewed for, it didn't go like a normal interview. I wasn't a normal applicant. But the point is, that kind of question, wouldn't that cause a person to lie to you? What are your weaknesses? Are you going to tell somebody what your weaknesses are?
Well, that's the whole point of the book is, like, why can't I be me? Because you really can't be you. And I hate to say, like, you have to lie in your job interview, because I would never say, you know, you can't lie about, you know, your education, your work experience, sure, and all those different things. But when it comes to things like that, what's your biggest weakness, or if you've been fired before? I mean, you cannot say that if you want to get hired, because the facts are you do have to get a job. This is money that you need to live on. So you could go years, if not your entire life, totally unemployed simply because you're being honest about who you are. So you have to say the right thing. And I mean, that was very clear to me as a person who was interviewing. But when I was coaching people, and I've been doing that for over a year now, and people are giving me their honest answers, I found myself saying, no, don't say that. You can't say that. Here's why. And then I tell them something else to say.
Yeah.
And so the whole process is ineffective because employers have no idea who they're hiring.
You know, and that's kind of an interesting position, and we wonder why there's such trouble in the job market today. And I say trouble, what I've found over the years now doing consulting back and forth, you know, you walk into a place, you sit down with the CEO, CFO, whoever, COO, and you sit down and you say, let's go to your subordinate, and whatever that person is. And then we say, let's write down what that subordinate's job is. And so the CEO writes it down. Then you go to that person, you say, write down what you think your job is. And they write it down. And 9 out of 10 times, Jessica, it's not the same definition. You know, and I think that's one of the biggest problems. If I have to go into a job on a lie, and I get my own idea of what I should be doing, how does that affect the bottom line? I think it affects it tremendously with the kind of income that comes in.
Well, I mean, the first thing that happens is the manager who hired you is walking around saying, where's the person from the interview? You know, now you show up at work and you're being yourself. So you're not showing all these traits that you said that you had in the interview. So you're not that person. That causes some sort of a disconnect between yourself and the manager. And of course, you know, 80-some percent of people are disengaged at work, and this is the path to getting you right on the train with the rest of them. So with that many people being disengaged, it's no wonder that no work is being done, because people cannot put themselves, you know, 100% into any job when they're disengaged. The most you can put in this job where you're not really happy is about 77%.
You know what I think I would do if I was hiring somebody? I would sit down with them and I'd look at them right in the eyes and say, what can you do for me? And just shut up and let them talk.
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing that you say that, because I've tried to word questions that way just to kind of leave it wide open. But yeah. People are smart. I mean, it's a tough job market out there. Not only is there a lot of unemployed people, but there's a whole lot of people out there that are switching jobs this year. So the job market is very competitive and people are learning. Don't say more than you have to say, and, you know, keep your answers short, only the 2 minutes. You know, there's so much advice out there that people are coming in prepared, and it's obvious. As an interviewer, it was very obvious to me when I was getting canned answers and people were prepared. But what really happens is the person who gets the job is the person who interviewed the best, not necessarily the best candidate.
Yeah, I remember that years ago. I will tell you a secret that has to stay with us. You can't tell anybody, okay? Sir, okay. It was probably 20, 25 years ago. It was summertime, and I was running out of money, and I had to do something. And I noticed this ad in the paper that said, used car sales. So I'm driving down the street. Now, I didn't turn into that lot. The car did, okay? So I turned the lot, and I walked in. I sat down. The guy looked at me, and he said, what do you know about cars? I said, what do I have to know about cars? I can sell anything. He said, when do you want to start? I mean, that's just, it was, what was he looking for? Somebody who could sell something. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, if we know what those people want and they don't force us into lying to them, my goodness, it could be great fits.
I mean, there definitely could be. I mean, if people could just walk in and be themselves, it would be a whole different ballgame. But the facts are, when you can't be yourself, I mean, that's kind of how it is at work, too. I mean, if you're setting in to a new job and you want to be promoted, you got to learn, you know, what are the right things to say and do? What do I say to this person? What do I say in this meeting? What can't I say? What can't I do? And so you're going down this path like that, and you're just, it's ripping away at your self-esteem. You know, you're constantly aware of the fact that who you are isn't good enough. So you've got to be somebody else. But no one's really telling you, what is it that you need to be or what skills you need to have? So people just naturally are just becoming disengaged. And there's a lot of other reasons people become disengaged, but that's a big one, because if you have to walk around saying things totally different from what you're thinking in your head, then you're losing integrity with yourself. And if you don't have that, then you don't feel good about yourself. And that goes on, you know, long enough, it's just not going to work. It's not going to make you feel good, and you're not going to be able to do a good job.
Now, by the way, I'm sitting here listening to what you're saying, and let me finish this statement, because I know it's going to sound like I'm in front. I don't like anything that I'm hearing, and what I'm having to say is thank God that there's people like you out there to hold people by the hands, or there'd be messes out there.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the concerns that I have, because I see this problem so clearly, and I'm not exactly sure why I'm not seeing more of it out there. But what I want to help people do, and what I help people do in my business, is learn how, well, first of all, they have to understand, if you're going to go into a job interview and you're going to say these things that you've learned to say, then that's who you have to be when you get to work. So let's help you develop. Here's the skills that employers are looking for. Here's what makes a top performer, and this is what employers want. They want someone that they see potential as being a top performer, potential leader. Whatever it is, it's got to be someone performing at a high level. So let's look at you and see what it is about you that you need to do to get you there, and then help them develop into that person so they can actually succeed once they get hired.
I learned a very valuable lesson when I was 18 years old. That was the first job interview that I ever had. And I was working for Norris Thermidor Corporation in Southern California, And I was 18 years old, 19 years old. And what I was doing was I was standing there 8 hours a day, and it was mids. It was from 5 o'clock until midnight. And there was a kid with no social life, right? And they would come up with a pallet with tire wheels on it. And for 8 hours, 9 hours, 10 hours a day, when we got overtime, I would pick up the wheel, I'd put it on a conveyor belt. Pick up the wheel, put it on a conveyor belt. Didn't think, but I was built like you wouldn't believe after all that.
Now, I bet you were.
And I went into the personnel office, and I said, I'd like to get on days. And they said, this is union stuff way back. They said, how long have you been working here? I said, a month. And after, they got up off the floor from laughing at me, right? And so I started to walk out, put my hand on the door, and I turned around and I looked at the guy and I said, I have half a brain here, and if you let me use it, I'm sure I can benefit this company. He said, come back tomorrow. One thing led to the other, and I found out that there was an opening in the chem lab. They needed a chem technician. I had chem 1 in high school, and I got a D in it. And I walked in, and I met the chemical engineer, and I loved every second of him. He was one of these old intellectual fuddy-duddies. And he said to me, I said, I've had chemistry in high school. And he said, you know, you don't put acid into water. I said, water into acid. I mean, there was only one answer. He said, that's it. Come to work Monday. And I was a chemical analyst for 3.5 years. So the lesson that I learned was this: be open, because there might be something in that job interview, a job that you might even be a better fit for that you didn't even know existed.
That's very true. I mean, I struggle a little bit to see how that works in some of the bigger corporations, because, you know, there's such a convoluted process now. These interviews, there's like 3, sometimes there's 4 interviews, and they go on for 1 hour, 2 hours. There's lunch interviews, so there's a whole big process that goes on with that. But there's a lot of job experts out there that feel like you really do have to have a definite plan for yourself. This is what I want, and you're not going to deter from that because that's what impresses employers. But in what you're saying is very true as well, and people are qualified for a lot of other jobs. But if you leave yourself open to that, then employers might think, well, they don't really know what they want. You know, they're not sure of themselves. They don't have a direction. So that can go both ways.
Okay, what I was saying was this. All right, I walk in, I'm applying for a job in the accounting office, all right? So I want the job in the accounting office. They have all the qualifications and the rest of it. But at the same time, they're listening. They got 4 or 5 people applying for that job. But I happen to mention as part of my background that I have a strong strong background in communications and presenting. And it would just happen to mention it. Maybe they've got an opening there for somebody that could go out and market who they are and whatever it is, and they might say, oh, you know, there's this opening here. Let's see if we can get them over there. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that does happen sometimes. I mean, I'm not certain how forward an applicant should be in bringing that up. You know, I'm open to other jobs, but I've done this myself in an interview. You know, I've come across some really great people, not a good fit for what I was interviewing them for, but we did have a different position that we thought that they would be a good fit for. So we approached them with that and said, you know, this may not be a good fit for you, but what do you think about this? And then you got to really pay attention, because a lot of times, you know, a lot of people are desperate to get back to work and they'll do anything. So you got to really listen to those answers, because some people may say they're really interested in that and they're not. And last thing you want is to bring someone in and then have them leave as soon as they find something better.
Oh, sure. By the way, if it was a toss-up between following your advice and mine, I'd follow yours.
Well, sure. I mean, things are different. You know, years ago, I mean, even before the Facebook era, as soon as like 5, 6 years ago, things were very different, but things have really stepped up now. I mean, the whole lines between personal and professional life are blurred, and everything has just really changed up since, you know, well, there's obviously tight competition and all that, but the whole social media thing and different ways of finding jobs and finding hiring managers and all that has really changed things up quite a bit. And higher. The standards are higher now.
Now, we got a couple of minutes to go, so let's touch on this. And it's very important. While doing your job isn't enough to be promoted, what do you have to do?
Well, it's almost like what you were saying before. I mean, there's so many people that come into work, and they're going to do their job, and they're going to do exactly what they're supposed to do, and they're going to do it well. And then all this time goes by, maybe it's a year, maybe it's 5 years, and they're walking around like, I'm not getting promoted. What's going on? You know, they're getting very discouraged by that. But the facts are, if that's what you came in to do is just your job, employers are not really impressed with that. You know, they want you to come in and do your job like you own that place. Not as if you're going to take it over, but you like having the caring about it as if you owned it. So you really care. You want this company to really move fast and forward. And so you're going to do anything to help it do that. You'll go above and beyond. You'll help out in different departments. You'll volunteer for committees. You'll really put yourself out there. And those are the people that employers look at. It's like, okay, these are the people we need to, you know, target as our future leaders of the company. And these are the people that, you know, we want to move forward in our company. And the rest, you know, the rest are like worker bees. You know, they're doing what they have to do. They come in at 7:59, they leave at 5:01, but they do a good job. But that's never going to be enough, just doing your job, if you want to get ahead.
I hear you loud and clear. Now, by the way, we're out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. My website is www.careerbrandauthority.com. And I have a free ebook on there, and I'd love for people to come on and grab that. And I give out a lot of great tips and advice and different things you could do that are long-term fixes to this career struggle that most people are in, and not a short-term fix where you kind of go in and do and say the right things and just get a job just to lead to a lot of struggles along the way.
Oh, and I hear you loud and clear. Hey, by the way, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, good night.
As sweet a young child as you find. Her parents had gone to their final reward, leaving their baby behind. Did you hear this poor little child was only 9 years of age when mother and dad went away? Still she bravely worked at the one thing she knew to earn her few pennies a day. She made artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, you know those artificial flowers, fashioned from Annie's despair. With paper and shears, with some wire and wax, she made up each tulip and mum. As snowflakes drifted into her tenement room, her baby little fingers grew numb from making artificial flowers. Artificial flowers, flowers for ladies of high fashion to wear. She made artificial flowers, artificial flowers, made from Annie's despair. They found little Annie all covered with ice, still clutching her poor frozen shears. Amidst all the blossoms she had fashioned by hand and watered with all her young tears, there must be a heaven where it lies.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Victoria Hopwell with us. She's the author of Grade A Baby Eggs, an Infertility Memoir. That's her pen name. Of a PhD yes. Clinical psychology. Yes, and we got that one. And you've interned in the psychiatry department of Harvard Medical School and instructor in psychology at the medical schools of both Harvard and Cornell. She's now in private practice in New York, where she's counseled infertile couples. And hi, we're going to say pen name, Victoria, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, with this infertility problem, and it's a problem. Sometimes it's amazing of how many couples and how many people in this country. I mean, we go into the tens of millions who have the problem, and they search for all of the different, you know, the possibilities of solutions and answers. Some of them find it. Some of them don't. Some of them wind up, you know, more disappointed than when they first found out that they couldn't have a child. So let's touch on the egg, basically, the donor eggs. Let's define what they are, create a base, and then we can work from there.
Okay, well, donor eggs is something that people end up using a lot now, and actually it's been in the media a lot because women are now using donor eggs. There's even been articles in their 50s and 60s. But there are many reasons why people use donor eggs. Basically, if your own eggs won't work, either because there's some kind of issue or you're getting older, because once you're in your 40s, your chances are in the single digits, or if you're even in menopause and you want to have a baby at this point, people can have babies by using the donor eggs, which means that you're getting the egg from either a younger woman or a woman who doesn't have fertility issues, so their eggs hopefully will work, and then you can use the sperm of your significant other or of someone else to put into the donor egg, and then you can either carry the baby yourself or have a surrogate carry the baby.
Okay, now let me ask you, the donor eggs. Now, obviously, it costs to get them, and there are places where they specialize in doing so. Are they safe? Are there problems using these eggs?
Well, the thing is that using the eggs, there are some very minimal things, you know, that there are regulations for. Generally, it's not a regulated industry using donor eggs at all, but it is that they will screen the hospitals when they do the procedure, because it actually is going to take an operation to take them out of somebody else, put the sperm in it, and then put the egg in you. So they will screen for things like AIDS or some kind of disease where it could actually be an issue for the mother and or for the baby. However, you know, the rest of the donor egg stuff is sort of like the Wild West, where there's all kinds of claims of whose eggs you may be getting, but they may not be who you think you're getting because there's really not much regulation, and it's the case where some eggs are, you know, worth more than others. So, for example, people pay more for eggs that where the woman says she has high SATs, looks like a model, and previously produced twins or triplets.
Now, by the way, is this an unregulated industry?
Yes, it is basically unregulated. And in fact, you know, in my book, Grade A Baby Eggs, at the very end, I put in a section called Cracking the Egg Donor Industry, Recommended Reforms, because there are many areas where there could be regulations. For example, there are no price controls, so it's sort of like Animal Farm, where some people charge more than others. The eggs from the high SAT people and the people who are models, or at least say they are, can get 50 to even up to, people may advertise 100,000 for Ivy League eggs. And other people will get much less, and the agencies will list them as the ordinary egg. So there's no regulations in how much people are charging. And so that's one area that definitely can have regulation. And there also were no regulations in terms of what egg you're getting. So if you don't have documentation, you know, people will list themselves as being Olympic athletes, being musical divas, and whether or not that's the case is really, you know, not clear. Other countries do have more regulations, but you can go too far on the other extreme. So, for example, in Australia and in New Zealand, they will not allow the donor to be paid for donating their eggs because they feel it's unethical to have to pay for that. But then on the other hand, that causes a major issue because most people won't donate for free with all the dangers that are involved. And then you have huge waiting lists and people fleeing the country and flocking other places to get their donor eggs.
Now, by the way, this brings up an interesting question. And the question would be this. Let's say that I was in that condition or situation where I was married, we couldn't have a child, we decided to do the eggs. What about counseling? And when I say what about counseling, there are people that have a tremendous amount of questions. They walk into something cold, they don't get their questions answered, and there's a lot of trauma, a lot of heartache, and it could be problems for that child that gets born also. So is there counseling specifically targeted to the infertile parent that may use the donor egg?
Yes, and definitely I think it's very needed. There are people who will specialize in doing individual counseling. There also are groups. Resolve, the National Infertility Association, sponsors some of those. It's a very traumatic process to go through trying to get IVF, whether you're using someone else's eggs or your own, what with all the blood drawings and the hormone shots and then the, you know, ultimate wait to see if you get pregnant or not, which can be devastating because if you don't, it really is mourning the death of your child, which is something I did, you know, five times with my own eggs when it didn't work any of the times with my own eggs. So counseling is very important, but it's not always easy to find somebody or even to find a group. So, for example, with one hospital, I really wasn't sure. I was ambivalent about using a donor egg, and I wanted to go to a group, and I was told that they didn't have any because the women were so secretive and felt there was such a stigma about saying they used a donor egg that they didn't have any groups because no one wanted to know that they were using a donor. And in fact, many women never even planned to tell their own child that they used a donor.
Okay, so in essence, we're talking about something that most people are embarrassed about. They want to keep it under the covers, and they want no one to know. And I think that in and of itself has got to be the key for counseling. Obviously, you're talking about it. You went through the same thing. And I would, if I had the problem, I would rather go to someone who's been there and done that as opposed to the academic, the guidelines and the steps to do what we're going to do. A couple of interesting statistics right out of your press release. 8 babies are born in the U.S. every single minute. Conception, all of it, okay, would seem to be natural. But we're talking about 7.3 million individuals in the U.S. whose eggs and sperm aren't quite up to the task. So what we're dealing with really are a tremendous amount of people who have the problem wanting to have a family and not knowing where to go, or better yet, not knowing how to do it.
Right. Yes, there's an enormous amount, and that's what's too bad about people being so secretive about it, because it is 1 out of 8 couples in America that have infertility issues. And if people were less secretive and more open, there would be less of a stigma. And even, you know, a lot of times people will hear about celebrities that end up having babies at these older ages, like in their late 40s and 50s, and that really means that they used a donor egg. But people don't talk about that, and so there's all these urban legends that at any point you can just have a baby and it'll just, you know, come right out no matter how old you are, and that's really not the case.
Okay, now, by the way, you wanted a child, obviously. That was your main goal. Was there anybody that you would have listened to give you advice on how to do it, where to do it, et cetera? Or did you just say, this is what I want, and that's what I'm going to have no matter what?
What I did is I really wanted a baby. So, I really didn't listen to many people, including my own parents, who felt I was too old to have a child at that point. They were afraid that, it would cause major medical issues. So I would have forged ahead no matter what. But it would have been very helpful had I had other women to speak to who had gone through it. And also, if the doctors could say from the beginning with more of a sense of what it's like to give up using your own baby. So when I went in, because I was early in my 40s, almost mid-40s, the doctor immediately told me just use a donor egg. And for me, that was devastating, and I was not ready to hear it. And maybe I still wouldn't have heard it, but it would have been helpful to have had that discussed, to hear about how there is a mourning process to not using your own egg, that it is an option that has better chances, but you have to be willing to accept it. And I think there really needs to be much more discussion with people when they're starting this process, both from the physicians, also offered counseling, and if there was some sort of forum for people to meet each other who were going through this, rather than sitting alone in the waiting room with 100 people waiting for your blood drawing, you could feel like you could talk to other people and share your stories and feel a sense of support.
And by the way, the word support, I think, is an extremely important word. I don't know how many times a week, and with all of the interviews that we do here, that word has to come up. You can get all the help that you want, but it's going to take a support group. And the family could be, quote-unquote, the support group. But it would be great if somebody decided that they wanted to do, they wanted to go this way, and a place that they could email, a website that they could go to get the information to know that when they did do it, they were on the right track, and to become aware of the pitfalls and the rest of it. Now, did you go through and have a baby this way?
Well, what happened for me is I tried, 5 times with my own eggs. My husband the whole time was much more, gung-ho about me using a donor egg with the chances would increase to 50 to 60% versus 9% or less. And I did ultimately try donor egg twice. The first time, the donor themselves ended up having eggs that didn't work. So the cycle couldn't be completed. Their eggs didn't grow. It was the first time they had ever donated. The second time, I did have a donation from somebody who had impregnated two other people. But in my case, it did not work either time.
Okay, so...
I ended up not pregnant.
Oh, but what was the end result for you? Not just not pregnant. What was the lesson in it for you?
Well, the lesson was, at first it really truly was devastating, but there were a number of lessons. One lesson really was that in the end I felt, even with 20/20 hindsight, that I had seven attempts, that I really needed to do that. I needed to know that I did everything I could to try to have that baby with my husband, and that I tried everything possible, and though even though it didn't work, it allowed me to then move forward, you know, with a lot of mourning in the process. And then from there, I was able to focus on being able to have a life with other factors, like my marriage with my husband and my friends and other things in my life besides having, you know, that baby with my husband. And my husband, you know, also had to reach some resolution. You know, he was the eighth generation in an unbroken line from a very famous Jewish scholar, and he wanted to continue his line, which he didn't. He broke it. But in the end, he decided he was going to be involved with creating some sort of a line in the name of the scholar and his father at the temple, and feel that he still would have a way to have things be meaningful without having his own child as well.
Now, by the way, was adoption ever an option for the two of you?
It was discussed, because in some ways, originally, it was like a little bit of an uneven playing ground, in the sense, you know, and that if we used the donor egg, it would have been his genetics and not mine. With adoption, it felt like we both wanted that, would want that baby so much that we would adopt and not care about the genetics, which ultimately I think, you know, what is the most important is the baby. But in the end, we decided not to do it. It was a big process. We were both older, and in the end, you know, the genetics really were pretty important to my husband. His genetics.
Well, that makes sense. And when I say it makes sense because he was focused. There was a goal he wanted to accomplish, and if it was done... actually, if it was done in any other way than him, quote unquote, being the lead there, it wouldn't have ended up accomplishing the goal.
Right. Yes, but we definitely did discuss it, and you know, and there were points he wavered in terms of, you know, that we would get a baby that way at least.
Okay. Now, by the way, if someone came to you and sat down and was in that position where they could not have a baby, what would you recommend to them?
Well, I would recommend that they really do two things. One is that you really do need to mourn not being able to have a baby, because it's very hard to make decisions about what you want to do when you're in the process of mourning. And in fact, you know, people who go through infertility are really at great risk even for becoming depressed. You know, and the new DSM-5 is going to talk about how mourning the loss, you know, mourning a death can make people feel depressed, and not having a baby or trying and it not working can be like having multiple mournings of your children over and over again. So they need to be able to address that, but then there can be many positives, because first of all, there are ways to still have a baby, whether it be donor egg, whether it be adoption. And if not, in the end, people really can come to a resolution and feel that they can go forward, and things can turn out, and there can be many things in life that are meaningful, even if you go forward, you know, without having that child.
Okay, but now, but you do have children, though.
Yes. Well, and that's the thing. I was married before, so I have two children, and my husband was not married before and had no children. And so that, you know, was a difference as well. You know, and it also created more complications, because soon after we got married, we began, you know, infertility treatments. And so in the midst of doing these infertility treatments, we were also blending our family together, and both of my children were not for me having a baby. They were only for us getting a puppy. And so, you know, their reactions were involved too, especially when it came to using a donor egg and having to discuss that with them. So there were many players in this, and we all had different views on it.
That must have been, did the Prozac flow heavy for a few months?
That's a good question. Well, it certainly could have, because, and in fact, people growing to infertility are found to have, marital tensions, and certainly it can affect your sex life, having all these shots. And on top of that, we were trying to have, my husband, who was a confirmed bachelor, deal with two young children, and my children, dealing with a possible baby, and me disappearing to have these treatments. So, yeah, we definitely probably could have used the Prozac.
Okay, Victoria, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, find the book, and get more information?
Yes, you can go to gradeababyeggs.com. You can find out more about the book. I have a blog on it, and I'm also available to come to book clubs if they're in the New York area, or to Skype or talk about them if people, read the book, and then it can certainly make for lively discussions.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I hope anybody out there listening in that situation, condition, at least they have a place to go, because everybody needs to symbolically be held by the hand when they don't know what path to take.
Right. Yes. And thank you so much. I've greatly enjoyed talking with you.
Great. Okay. Good night.
Good night.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment,
I'm Michael Braydresser,
and I'm Radio Susie,
and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling we're parting as friends. Your cheers and laughter will